From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Enbridge Energy's take on its new Line 5 agreement with the state of Michigan.
We believe there doesn't need to be a choice between either protecting the environment or meeting the state's energy needs.
The DNR tracking chronic wasting disease in Michigan's deer.
There's really no way to eradicate the disease, and that's what's the challenge is. Once you have it, you have it.
A near-death experience as a patient gives a physician new insights into communicating with her patients.
We don't always say things in a way that promotes healing. We can actually be adversaries to our patients in many ways.
And Michigan's interesting history of smuggling oleomargarine? Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All through this deer hunting season, Michigan's hunters are bringing their deer to check stations to be tested for a disease called chronic wasting disease, or CWD. It's turning up in deer in our state, which is why the DNR is keeping a very close eye on this threat. Chad Stewart is a deer specialist with the Michigan DNR. Chad, just what is chronic wasting disease?
Chronic wasting disease is a slow-moving but progressive disease that affects the central nervous system of members of the deer family. It's caused by something called a prion, and a prion is a misshapen protein. So what happens is the deer ingest these prions, and over time, it slowly degrades the central nervous system, especially the brain of the animal, and basically causes it to lose neurological functioning over the course of about, on average, a year and a half to 2 years.
So a deer could be carrying this disease for quite a while before it actually dies of CWD.
Correct. Deer that have CWD generally look the same as a deer that does not have CWD. The only difference is right at the end of their life stage, and the disease has progressed to this point where it's causing symptoms in the deer. So what happens is the deer becomes emaciated, it loses neurological functioning, it loses any sort of stimulus to some sort of external action. So ultimately, the deer do look very thin, skinny at the end of their cycle, end of the life cycle, but it takes about a year and a half to 2 years on average before it gets to that point.
In the meantime, it's in contact with other deer. Is that how it's passed along?
Yeah, the deer remain infectious throughout their entire life cycle, even when they're not what we call symptomatic. And the prions are generally passed through bodily fluids, so saliva, feces, urine, and obviously with deer being social animals, it's easy to pass it from one animal to another. The more insidious part of this disease is that these prions really resist any sort of degradation, so they can remain in the environment for years and potentially decades. So one deer can infect another deer without ever coming into direct contact with
it. Wow. What is the official stance on eating deer meat from infected deer?
Well, from the DNR standpoint, we tend to follow the experts, and those experts are places like the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control, and basically they recommend if you have a known CWD-positive animal, we don't recommend you eat it. There's been no known documentation of anybody contracting CWD from eating a contaminated animal, but that being said, the likelihood of it happening is probably very low but greater than zero. So be cautious about it and don't consume an animal that you know has CWD.
Chad, how many deer in Michigan have been confirmed to be CWD positive since you started watching for it?
Confirmed, I think we're at about 13 deer. That number is going to be changing here because we are finding what we call suspect animals, which are animals that are looking like they have CWD. It just hasn't been confirmed through an independent laboratory analysis. That number seems to be changing by the week.
So how much of a threat do you believe this is to Michigan's deer herd and to the future of deer hunting in our state?
I think it's probably long-term one of the biggest threats that we have to deer management and deer hunting in this state. Short-term, CWD is not a problem. You don't see impacts to the deer population right away. Unfortunately, what happens is, and what we're seeing from other states that have been dealing with this for 40-plus years, is that when you get CWD at very high levels, especially locally, in high levels meaning one out of every two, one out of every three deer, it can start to have population level impacts on your deer herd. And certainly we're not there yet, and we don't want to be there. And that's why we're trying to maintain an aggressive approach and response to this disease.
Yeah. So how does the DNR attack this? How do you contain this?
There's really no way to eradicate the disease. And that's what's the challenge is. Once you have it because of the environmental contamination component. So really what it amounts to is really focusing on some of those social groups that have it, you know, where we have known CWD positive animals. We try to conduct very intensive management in those areas. So removing more deer than you typically would see from general hunting. And we try to supplement it that way. In the meantime, we're doing surveillance in the surrounding areas. So we're picking up roadkill deer. We're having hunters submit deer for sampling to constantly check what the boundaries of our known CWD area is in the state.
How personally worried are you about CWD?
It's a good question. I think it's probably going to be one of the bigger issues, certainly that sort of manifests itself over the course of my career, and hopefully my career lasts at least another two decades or so. So I think it's going to be one of the big things. I think it's going to be one of those things that we're always going to be talking about it, and we're constantly going to be trying to find new ways to solve it. And as of right now, I think we have more questions than answers on it.
Chad Stewart, deer specialist with the Michigan DNR. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week brought the announcement that Enbridge Energy of Canada has entered into an agreement with the state of Michigan focusing on the future of Line 5, which carries some 23 million gallons of petroleum products every day. It calls for Enbridge to replace the stretch of Line 5 that runs under the St. Clair River, putting in a new pipeline underground and encasing it in a tunnel. And it requires a study of what it would take to lay the pipeline in a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac. With us now is Ryan Duffy, who is a spokesman for Enbridge Energy Partners. Ryan, welcome. What do you think of this agreement?
Well, I can tell you we've listened to the concerns from state officials and people in Michigan, and we worked with the state closely to put this agreement in place. We embrace this agreement as a vital step in a positive direction, an opportunity to do the right thing to serve Michigan and also protect the waters of the Great Lakes. And we know trust is earned, and we know we have a long way to go with that, but we remain committed to doing what it takes to rebuild that trust and doing that partly through these seven action items that are part of this agreement.
Now, one of the elements of the agreement calls for Line 5 under the Straits to be shut down during, and I'm quoting here, adverse weather conditions. Why did Enbridge agree to this?
We do, of course, always prepare for the worst. We train for waves and high waves and those kind of conditions. And we do have equipment staged around the area there and emergency response equipment and boats and other things like that. So we are, of course, prepared, but I think, again, it goes back toward building trust, and we heard concerns from people about this, so we put this agreement in here as a way to just go above and beyond for safety.
And what do you see as the goal of this study that must be done by next August?
Well, it really lays out a path forward for addressing the future of Line 5 and operating Line 5 safely well into the future. These are some good options that we're considering, particularly there for moving toward replacing the dual pipelines that are there at the Straits in that section. So we think this is a positive step going forward. This is what we need to do, and this will make the line even safer.
You know, Ryan, there are many people who believe when it comes to Line 5, Michigan's getting all the risk and very little of the benefits. What do you say to that?
Well, that's not the case at all. Enbridge, Enbridge operating the line, Line 5 is really vital and pivotal to the quality of life many people in Michigan enjoy and also important to the state's economy. On an average day, Line 5 transports 22 million gallons of light crude and natural gas liquid. So that's going to refineries around the state and also in the region as a whole. So Line 5 really does serve the region as a key part of its energy infrastructure. 80% of the Michigan-produced crude oil produced by Michigan companies located in the northern part of the state, they use Line 5 so their products can get to refineries. And, of course, Line 5 transports 55% of the propane used statewide, 65% used in the UP. So you can imagine, especially now going into the winter months, that really is vital for people who need it to cook their food and heat their homes. And so when you look at that larger picture, you really do see how vital Line 5 is to the state.
I'm wondering how many households, according to U.S. Census data, there are some 3.8 million households in Michigan. How many of them depend on energy from Enbridge's Line 5?
Well, I'm not sure about the household number. I can tell you that Michigan as a state uses more propane than any other state, and Enbridge does supply the majority of that. So
you
can see how people rely on it.
But when we use the percentages, for example, the 65% of in the UP relying on Enbridge Energy, how's that calculated without knowing the number of households?
Well, I don't personally know the number of households, but we know the amount we're delivering to our customers. So we know how much is going out in that area and how much is going out statewide.
What is your case for why Michigan residents should accept the risks that are associated with Line 5, Ryan?
Oh, well, like I said, Line 5 does serve a crucial role in the state, and people do rely on it, and it's critical to the state's economy. So we believe there doesn't need to be a choice between either protecting the environment or meeting the state's energy needs. You can safely do both. And this new agreement we've reached with the state, that's going to be a key part of that, because it really does increase safety, put new protections in place, and it'll do that for Line 5 well into the future.
Ryan Duffy, spokesman for Enbridge Energy Partners. Ryan, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, thank you.
In full disclosure, Enbridge Energy is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. Coming up, we talk with the Michigan History Center and learn about margarine smuggling along the Wisconsin border. Then a critical care physician shares her perspective as a patient in the intensive care unit.
What surprised me the most was really how poorly trained we are to give bad news well.
That comes up in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
If you ever hear the terms Great Lakes and smuggling, you might think of whiskey running during the Prohibition. But did you know there was a different kind of smuggling along the Wisconsin border until the late 1960s? It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And back with us today is Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, the smuggling we're about to discuss does not involve guns or alcohol or beaver pelts, but rather
oleomargarine.
Oleomargarine.
Yes.
Well, I know our younger listeners are going, oleomargarine? What is oleomargarine? So, as probably the resident senior, I'm going to explain, because I remember doing this with my grandmother. You would have a brick of white stuff, and in it was a little button, and you would squeeze it, and out would come a yellow dye, and you would knead it together, and you had yellow oleomargarine, which I believe, I love the description that it was the working man's spread. So how did this become illegal?
Well, when margarine came out, it was a cheap substitute for butter. So the butter industry began lobbying for rules and regulations against its sale and distribution. And these laws were particularly strict in Wisconsin. So people started going into Michigan from Wisconsin and the UP and buying up oleomargarine and bringing it home with them. So there was a smuggling ring right at the border of Dickinson County.
When you think that margarine was developed during Napoleon's time in France, so was there a butter cartel trying to block the insidious spread of margarine?
Not quite that bad. It got pretty interesting, though, in the late 1800s. Napoleon III found he needed to feed his troops and the people of France with something cheaper than butter, more readily available than butter, and that lasted longer. So he put out almost this competition with a money prize to somebody that could come up with something. And so a French chemist named Hippolyte Mesmery, sorry if I just butchered his name.
Very good.
he came up with this butter substitute that we know today as oleomargarine.
Amazing. What were the tactics that were used and the arguments used to keep people from buying this yellow oleo?
It's kind of entertaining to look at it today. The butter industry started out with attacks at oleomargarine as being lowbrow and low class, evil and threatening to human and public health. And then in the mid-1880s, you start to actually see laws on the books, taxes and tariffs against the ingredients in oleo. You also get laws in Michigan where places that sell and produce oleo, they actually have to put signs up that say, "We use oleo," because they were saying, "Hey, we have great butter," and it wasn't butter. And there weren't any laws against that at the time.
So truth in advertising.
Absolutely. And then finally, in the 1890s, it becomes completely illegal in Michigan to manufacture or distribute oleomargarine. But those laws are impossible to regulate. People were doing it anyway. And so they start to lighten up a little bit in Michigan with it. By the mid-20th century, it starts to wane a little bit.
So Michigan lightened up, Wisconsin didn't. So there's this, you know, contraband smuggling of oleomargarine into Wisconsin.
There is. Some of the more interesting things, too, had to do with the color. As you mentioned earlier, oleo in its norm, sort of natural form, if you will, is a white color. And so they would add yellow. It actually started out in the company, they would add yellow coloring. And that was false advertising, according to Michigan law. And so the Congress actually imposed a tax on anything that was using yellow dye. And so margarine manufacturers just started using vegetable oil instead of animal oil in their product, and then adding these little packets so you could color it at home. So they were avoiding that tax by letting the public and the consumers color it at home.
I didn't. And who knew that when my grandmother was letting me help her knead that package of margarine, we were beating a tax.
Yep, absolutely.
So when did this stop being a thing?
Well, as I said, in the mid-20th century, oleo starts winning out. The Depression made it so people had to look at cheaper alternatives to butter, and oleo was that natural sort of, or not natural, but with that, that obvious cheaper option. At that time, you start seeing products like Parquet and Blue Bonnet. They come up in the 30s and 40s as these margarine spreads. And then World War II, the butter that is being produced in the United States is being shipped off to soldiers in Europe. So again, you get this increase in the use of oleo. And then by the 1960s, American laws start to lessen as a whole, and you can have them in public institutions and schools, and the military can use it in cooking. So for the whole United States, except for Wisconsin, by the 1960s, the laws against oleo have lightened up, if not gone away entirely.
And do we know if Wisconsin has finally dropped its legal opposition to oleo?
I think they have. I imagine if I looked closely, there would still be laws on the books in Wisconsin, but I think they finally realized the same thing that Michigan did, that it's really hard and expensive to pursue lawsuits against companies or individuals that are violating these laws. But the smuggling continued up through the 1960s and into the early 70s. Wisconsin people would drive into Iron Mountain or Kingston in the Upper Peninsula, buy as much oleomargarine as they could, and then drive it back home into Wisconsin.
That's the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thanks so much, Rachel, for sharing this story of oleomargarine smuggling from Michigan's not-too-distant past. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It began with unbearable pain, an alarming development for a woman 7 months pregnant. And before too long, Dr. Rena Audish was losing her grip on life.
All at once, I felt a sudden release and lightness. I could see the operating room clearly, although I struggled to orient myself. The view was deceptive, in the way pilots staring for too long at the horizon can sometimes suffer sensory illusions that cause them to mistake the sea for the sky. My orientation was inverted. I was falling up. I could see the frustrated anesthesiologist who was working on placing IV access as I crashed. I could see the monitoring equipment surrounding me, the obstetrical team readying with instruments to extract the baby. I could see myself on the table. It struck me that they were right. They were losing me. If I could see myself, perhaps I was already lost. I felt nothing. The pain miraculously gone. The panic surrounding the pain was gone. An anodyne peace. I felt weightless, buoyant, and very small. I watched the events unfold before me, unattached to any outcome, with an easy stillness. I had died.
Dr. Audish did not die, but she had to endure a very long, very tough recovery from the medical crisis that cost her the life of her unborn child. And as a physician who cared for patients in the intensive care unit, she learned profound lessons about how doctors and nurses practice medicine. Dr. Audish is with the Department of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Henry Ford Health System. Her new memoir is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. Dr. Rena Audish, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there you were, having what appeared to be a good, uneventful pregnancy, and then you're literally brought to your knees with pain?
That's right. I was 7 months pregnant when the pain came on out of nowhere.
And you wound up on an operating table and then in the ICU where you had been working at the very hospital at the where you worked as a physician. What happened to you?
We didn't know at the time, but I had a tumor in my liver that grows with pregnancy. And pregnancy is a very dangerous time for that reason. They're called hepatic adenomas. And it basically burst open while I was at dinner. And in the space of really 2 hours, I lost my entire blood volume into my abdomen, which led to most of my organs shutting down. I had kidney failure. My liver failed. I was unable to breathe unassisted. I was placed on life support, and I had a stroke from the lack of blood flow. So I really went from a critical care physician one moment to a critically ill patient. I had specifically targeted my own hospital. I felt that if anyone could help me, it would be us. I really believed in the care that we provided. And so that was a very purposeful decision to drive to Henry Ford.
So it's fair to say you were slammed with about as severe a medical crisis as could be. How long before it took you to get back to good health? And we should note, as we mentioned, sadly, you did lose your unborn baby. So you had that to deal with as well as the physical recovery.
Yes. And to be honest, as a physician, I knew how fortunate I was to recover from that catastrophic hemorrhage. And while certainly the loss of the baby was a sad moment for our family, it was not in any way unexpected. I was amazed that I had survived that and felt very grateful for the care that I had received. All in all, it actually took 8 years to recover, 5 surgeries and many ICU admissions and procedures. And I'm happy to say it'll be 2 years in February since I've been a patient in the hospital.
What most surprised you as a patient about the things that were done and said by your doctors and nurses as you went through this ordeal?
What surprised me the most was really how poorly trained we are to give bad news well. I knew the people caring for me, they are tremendously skilled, and I really respect the work that they do and that we all do. But what I realized was hard was telling me things about my kidneys failing or when the baby had died. Those things were actually hard for my providers to do well. And I recognized, you know, I similarly had trouble giving bad news well and really focusing on the emotional needs of my patients. They did an unbelievable job with the clinical care. And I believe I survived something that was truly unsurvivable. But I was left with this feeling of gosh, we don't always say things in a way that promotes healing. We can actually be adversaries to our patients in many ways.
Well, and you write in your book, and I'll quote you here, medicine is a culture that does not indulge suffering, though it is everywhere. It is the most important thing to attend to, and we are constantly dismissing it, pushing it aside, whether it's our own suffering or the patient's suffering or our family's suffering. We push it aside to get to the patient. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that's a product of our training. Medical training really is so focused on the disease itself. It's something we're enamored by. We chase it. And you'll still hear physicians say this is a really good case when it's something catastrophic for the person who's suffering with it. And our orientation is really to the disease itself. We are looking for it in patients without always an understanding of how it impacts them, how their course of their life is changed by these diagnoses.
And it takes a toll on, it's clear from your book, it takes a toll not just on the patients who have to have things said that are insensitive or somebody's kind of slouching against the door wall and kind of delivers some bad news and slouches out again, but it takes a toll on the caregivers.
You know, I'm so glad that you point that out, because that was truly the biggest revelation to me in writing the book. And when I sat with all of the events that happened and really looked at them in retrospect, I realized how much suffering was happening for providers, that, you know, myself included, when I lost patients that I wanted more than anything to help, there was no place to go with that. I didn't feel I could talk about it in a way that would promote my own healing. It's just not our culture. We move on to the next patient, whether it's in the next ICU bed or in the next clinical encounter. It's just what we do.
Well, and it strikes me that the things that make a physician a good physician, battling disease, treating it as you know, as an enemy to be destroyed, that takes a toll.
Absolutely. I think that whole paradigm that we've set up, where it is a war on cancer, it is a battle to be fought, that even that language can be harmful, not just for the patients, who then feel that if they're not quote unquote fighting, that they're giving up, but also for the physician, because if they're in a war against something, that's the only paradigm then, is to win or lose. And I think we have to reframe the language. We have to begin to think about it in terms of truly partnering and walking alongside our patients in the same direction through the illness rather than fighting against something.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rena Audish. Her memoir is In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. She is a critical care medicine specialist who wound up on the other side of the equation as a patient in and out of intensive care units for years, the intensive care unit at the hospital where she worked at Henry Ford Hospital. And you now run a program at Henry Ford called CLEAR Conversations. What does CLEAR stand for?
CLEAR stands for Connect, Listen, Empathize, Align, and Respect. And it really is the value system that we seek to embody in all of our training. So we believe that true healing happens in the context of a relationship, and that we must cultivate that connection with our patients, that we have to listen generously. We have to know what matters to our patients. We have to empathize when emotion enters the conversation, which I think traditionally physicians aren't as well trained to do. We stay in the cognitive channel much more than we do the emotional channel. We try to align with patient goals, which of course means knowing what matters to our patients, knowing what their values are, and then respect those values. So never put forth a treatment plan that isn't in alignment with what the patient would want for their life. There's so much that medicine can offer these days, but if it isn't in the context of what our patients want, it's relatively meaningless. We're doing it for ourselves then.
I'm wondering, do you see room for humor from physicians and nurses, the kind that helps them blow off the stress? You know what I'm talking about, that kind of dark humor.
You know, that was the only coping mechanism that I think was modeled to me in all of my training. And To me, it's sad that that was all that we had. We had that ability to joke about something and this sort of graveyard humor that sometimes happens in healthcare. But I really think it's a sign of a deeper level of distress that people don't necessarily know what to do with. And that's what's socially sanctioned within medicine, is that joking. And I'd like to see where we can get past that and talk really honestly about our feelings in a more constructive way.
Well, your book truly is a call to action to the medical profession and also has so many deep insights for patients and for family members. So really, it's everybody. And Dr. Oddish will be at Literati in Ann Arbor tomorrow night, Thursday the 30th at 7 p.m. And she'll be talking about this powerful memoir, In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. It is quite a powerful book, and it is good to know that you and your family did have the happy ending of eventually having your little boy, Walt. And by the way, your husband, Randy, Saint Randy.
Oh, he'll appreciate that. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, Michigan's long history with hate groups.
They gave cover to people who were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-Black.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. The New America Foundation tells us that between 2008 and 2016, far-right attacks outnumbered Islamic terrorism by almost 2-to-1 in this country, and those attacks were deadlier. That got us thinking about Michigan and its history with extremist groups. With us now is historian Joellen Vineyard from Eastern Michigan University. She's the author of Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. Joellen, when did we first see right-wing extremism come to Michigan, and in what form?
Well, the most recent form of the militia came to attention in 1994 when they saw men in camouflage marching and training. And then the Free Press and other areas picked it up and said, well, what's going on in Michigan? It's a cauldron of hate. It's always been a place of hateful right-wing extremists. So that's what prompted this book.
So we go back then.
We go back.
Decades.
Really way back even into the 19th century when farmers tore up railroad lines and Detroiters, some of them tore up the railroad lines because the railroad was coming through their neighborhoods or scaring the cows. And so there's been this sort of citizen participation and, you know, let's take charge. But the 20th century, the first real group that emerges is the Ku Klux Klan. And it's a reborn Klan, not like the Reconstruction Klan, not like the one that came more recently.
In the 60s. But when we talk, are we talking about the fact that the Great Migration
That's
brought
right.
black workers right. up from the South?
Exactly.
Looking for auto jobs.
That's right. That was the time when there were, in 1920, somebody estimated 1,000 blacks were arriving in Detroit every week. So the population was undergoing great upheaval, along with World War I that had just ended. And so that helps explain it. The economy was really struggling.
And how much of a foothold did the KKK get?
The KKK had more members in Michigan than in any state in the South in the 20s. It was a big group. And it wasn't just Michigan. Indiana had an even larger group and the head of the National Klan. Michigan probably, it's so hard to get a figure exactly, but I would guess that one out of every 10 people eligible to belong to the Klan, which meant you really had to be white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, probably one out of 10 belonged. If you take into account women who also formed their own group, and they had a group for children.
When we think of Klan activities in Michigan in the 20s, what did that look like? Because certainly people have that Reconstruction era Southern idea of them riding in on horseback. But what was going on in Michigan?
They rode in Model Ts. That was on their card when they applied for membership. It said, do you have a car and how many people will it seat? Because they needed cars to take people to rallies. So the automobile made it possible for them to organize in groups, and they would gather in farm areas right south Oakland County outside of Detroit, but across the state. They were spread throughout the state. It was not just a local urban phenomenon.
And what kind of crimes?
They burned crosses. That was the most visible. That was the first sign that they were in the neighborhood and organizing. They burned crosses on the highest hill. They boycotted Jewish Catholic businesses. There was not a lot of, you know, outlandish evil killing here like there was in the South.
The lynchings.
Right. The lynchings. We have a very few. Some might have gone unreported. But more than that, they were protesters and they saw themselves as American patriots. That's one of the key things.
You mentioned they kind of waned and then rose again in the 60s, which I guess we need to address the fact that there was Pastor Bob Miles of Howell,
right,
who died 25 years ago this month. But he was what, Grand Dragon of the Michigan Ku Klux Klan?
He was. He's the one who was involved in the Pontiac bus bombing at the time when judge ruled that Pontiac schools were segregated and they were going to have to bus students within. And then it moved on to cross-district busing as the next phase. But Miles was one with a group of friends who bombed the Pontiac buses in 1971. And he also was involved with his group in tarring and feathering the principal at Willow Run High School, who was trying to peacefully integrate the high school. He was a white man, and he was trying to peacefully integrate the high school, and they grabbed him, tarred and feathered him. And for the bombing and the tar and feathering, Miles went to prison for, I think, 7 years.
And even though he died 25 years ago, does his reputation and the fact that he was the Grand Dragon of the Michigan Klan, does that still hang over Howell?
It does. Howell has fought to get free from that, and it's not fair to label all of Howell as, you know, people involved in his version of the Klan. But their efforts so far, you know, have not worked out. That's all people remember about Howell.
I'm speaking with historian Joellen Vineyard, the author of Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. When the Klan in the 20s was burning crosses, one cross they burned was at 12 Mile Road in Woodward in Royal Oak in Oakland County. And that's when a Catholic priest named Father Charles Coughlin was setting up his new parish, the Shrine of the Little Flower. Anyone who drives by that corner sees that enormous church and that enormous stone crucifix that towers over that northeast corner of 12 Mile and Woodward, because Father Coughlin said, I'm going to build a cross that can never burn down. However, this is the priest who had a huge national radio audience throughout the Depression. Some call him the founder of hate radio. Let's take a quick listen to Father Coughlin in full-throated action before a cheering crowd.
We are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it.
So, tell us about Father Coughlin's radio program, which was listened to in homes across America during the Depression.
It had the biggest radio following of any program proportionally then or now. The Klan came in the Model T that powered them, and the radio was just new when Father Coughlin came to Detroit. And he struck up a friendship with someone in the radio world, and they decided initially he was going to broadcast catechism lessons, Bible stories for children. And then it morphed on and it grew bigger after the Depression hit. He started at 26, 27, he's starting. When the Depression hit in Michigan by 29, and actually it hit here earlier than elsewhere, he then started to segue into economic issues and part of social justice issues. He was, in the outset, he was a major force for social justice. He believed that people should not be accumulating these vast amounts of wealth while others had none. And he really had a very advanced version of what the government should do, which is what brought him to the attention of Franklin Roosevelt. Coughlin was a good friend, first of Frank Murphy. And at that time, Murphy had been in various political positions. and Murphy knew Roosevelt. So that was the connection between Coughlin and Roosevelt. But Roosevelt saw that Coughlin had a big audience, a Catholic audience that would serve him well in the elections. So Coughlin went to the convention in Chicago in 32, and he gave a speech. He was a very important cog in Roosevelt's whole operation. And then he didn't think Roosevelt moved fast enough. And so his sermons and his statements on radio started to get more and more harsh. And as that happened, of course, Roosevelt got more and more angry. First, he'd been calling the New Deal was Christ's deal. Then, within a while, he's saying the New Deal is the devil's deal. So then there was a rupture. And besides, Roosevelt didn't need him anymore. By 36, he didn't need Coughlin because he had that solid base.
So how did it evolve where there's this impression that Father Coughlin was against Jews and friendly to Hitler?
He was.
Yeah. How did that morph? So it's not just an impression.
It's not just a myth. The thing he was above all was Christian. And that explains his anti-Jewish attitudes and his support for Hitler. Besides that, he was against communism as the mortal enemy of Christianity and Catholicism. And he saw Hitler as standing as a bulwark against Russia. Communist Russia was his real nemesis.
So if awful things happen to Jews in Germany, oh well.
That's right.
Wow. I want to play the beginning of one of Father Coughlin's weekly radio addresses from 1938, and listen to the 1938 version of complaining about fake news.
We present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Good afternoon, my friends. Following last Sunday's broadcast, a vicious campaign of misrepresentation, based upon fancy and not upon fact, has been carried on not only against me, but against the cause I represent. They were centered upon the following unjustifiable accusations. 1. Coughlin attacks Jews in the most un-American speech ever delivered. 2. Coughlin defends Nazism and the Nazi pogroms, which means mass murder.
When you hear that...
Right. It's eerie.
Yeah.
I don't know that he really ever defended things like the pogroms. I don't know. In his speeches, I don't remember that as appearing. He was, interestingly enough, and I think this is a parallel in each one of these groups, he gave cover to people who shared his same ideas but who couldn't dare be vocal about it. So people who were already anti-Semitic could say, well, I'm not a Coughlinite. Listen to him. And the same thing had happened with the Klan. They gave cover to people who were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-black. And so that's the really deadly part about these groups. They gave cover, and because they were so extreme, they made the centrists toward the right centrists look like normal people. They made them look like they were really okay. And it happens in every one of these time periods.
And here we go
again.
And
here we are.
And we should note, Father Coughlin was finally muzzled by church
authorities.
He
was. Yes. They took away his broadcast in 1941, right after Pearl Harbor was bombed. FBI trucks, Army trucks came up to the shrine and loaded up all kinds of materials and took it back to Washington. It's very difficult. I found it more difficult to research Coughlin and find anything new than these other groups because a lot of his papers are buried someplace. And the archdiocese, if they have them, they don't share.
Well, we also know that there have been groups such as the John Birch Society in
right.
Michigan, the Black Legion, and of course you began by talking about the Michigan Militia. A little about those groups, John Birch Society?
The John Birch Society comes right out of the Cold War era. Its biggest issue is fear of communism, defense of America. They were people who supported Barry Goldwater, extremism and defense of liberty is no vice in 64. And the Birch Society is never as big as the Klan by any means, or certainly not the Coughlin followers. But the Birch Society was more middle class and even some upper class people who were dedicated to getting together and studying and being almost in cells like the communists that they so hated so that they could give factual information and they would report on people as being dangerous. The Birch Society has endured. I mean, they are still out there, but their numbers aren't much greater. But what they did was they were like a phalanx inside the Republican Party. And they made a very strong stand as a minority within the Republican Party, which was sort of a cacophony of various interest groups. And so they were able to have a great deal of influence.
And the Black Legion.
And the Black Legion, I didn't cover them in this book because I was looking at groups that really are grassroots-based. The Black Legion is more like the present-day Klan in that they're a hate group who just like to kill people and damage them. And they were in Detroit, and they did commit some murders. They were white supremacists. They were a fearsome group, but a tiny group of thugs, really.
Terrorists.
Yeah.
Domestic terrorists.
They were.
And the Michigan militia, that's more recent. We certainly saw a big burst in the 90s, but they're not gone.
They're not gone. The Michigan militia is an umbrella name for various groups. They aren't unified. There is no real solid Michigan militia. They tried that, but they could never get the factions all together. So what it is local groups, local brigades breaking, apart and with local leaders. And they work together sometimes. They fought, but they also work together. And what their concern was to protect the country from within. They were afraid that our leaders had been duped. They emerged at the time of Ruby Ridge, Waco. Clinton was president. They hated Clinton. The Monica Lewinsky affair, they were appalled, even though some of them were divorced and admitted to having affairs. They said, well, not in the Oval Office. So they're emerging like the other groups in their time.
We're going to be ready to protect our
That's
own
right.
from the government.
That's exactly. They were afraid the government would march on them.
Now, you are eager to make a point that Michigan has been a fertile breeding ground for extremist thought on the left as well.
That's right. That's another book if I wanted to ever get to it, or somebody else should. Because at the same time we have these groups on the right, we've had a very strong group on the left, and it starts right here in Ann Arbor. And always, all along, Teddy Roosevelt won in Michigan with the progressive vote when he ran in 1912. He won Michigan. So there have been progressive movements and efforts all along across the 20th century, the union movement. And some within the union movement are really at the far left end. The IWW had its headquarters in Detroit in the early part of the 20th century. You know, right on up through all of these years, there have been corresponding left-wing groups.
Would you say today, as we talk in 2017, looking at this history leading up to now, where would you put Michigan, Joellen, in terms of extremist or hate group activity? I know it's so much of it is underground.
Right. Right now, the Southern Poverty Law Center says Michigan has 28 hate groups that they have charted, which is a lot compared to others. Ohio has more, but Ohio is a bigger state. Wisconsin has fewer. So Michigan, throughout its history, really, from its founding, it's at the forefront of changes and developments that are happening nationwide. It's often a leader or very involved at the beginning. I mean, if you think back, we had the copper and iron ore industrialized companies and factories well before many other places. Then we've got the auto industry. And so we're always at the forefront. We go into the Rust Belt early on, too.
So our economy has great highs and great lows. Does that make us more susceptible?
It makes people very fearful. You know, you can get rich, but you can lose it all too here. You can find the American dream or it will be dust at your feet.
And then when that happens, you go looking for someone to blame.
You do. You have to find somebody to blame. And the trouble is with all these groups, you know, they come and go, but they leave an impression or a legacy within the community, because they really got a lot of these ideas from within the community anyhow, but they leave a lasting legacy that then gets codified. It gets built into law. In the 20s, we get immigration quotas. In the 30s, we get Roosevelt's programs. We get anti-communism at its peak here in the 60s and 70s. And so all along, these people are at the forefront of nationwide movements. And although they're small and they seem like kooks to some others, but they have a big, lasting impact. And that's what's so frightening.
Well, our thanks so much to Eastern Michigan University history professor Joellen Vineyard for talking with us. Her book is Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.